What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
Russia has been boasting about a nuclear weapon no one else has.
I think the Kremlin is exaggerating a little bit. It's an exotic weapon. It does have the ability to fly very long ranges for very long periods of time, but it's not invincible.
Try telling that to Ukraine and its allies. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, the new arms race. Also, it's been violent in the Sudanese city of El Fasher, but in the past 48 hours, it's become unprecedented.
We have never seen a level of killing happen so fast, at such scale, with such systematic intent.
And in China, one man takes the fight to save his language and culture to kindergarten.
That's all ahead today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for coming along this Tuesday. The videos are hard to watch. I'm talking about the documentation circling online of attacks on civilians in the city of El Fasher in Sudan's Darfur region. People begging for their lives, young men lined up in the dirt and shot.
The atrocities are happening in broad daylight as Sudan's national military retreats from El Fasher. The city has been under siege for more than 500 days. Now, the militia known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, is in control. And aid groups are reporting that revenge killings have begun.
Those lucky enough to escape are fleeing on foot or piling into trailer trucks. Nathaniel Raymond is the director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. He joined me today to talk about what is known about the unfolding crisis based on his lab's high-resolution satellite imagery.
What we're seeing is evidence of RSF vehicles and personnel moving house to house across neighborhoods. And we see objects on the ground that weren't there 72 hours ago, visible in the street. And they're about a meter and a half to 2 meters long, which is the average length of a human body, an adult human, laying on the ground.
What else are you seeing in these images?
We're seeing objects consistent with human bodies near an earthen wall called the berm that the Rapid Support Forces have built in a formation we call a kill box surrounding the city. These walls are about 9 feet high, made with bulldozers, and we see at the base of them in trenches what appears to be, again, this meter and a half to 2 meter long piles of objects consistent with human bodies. And we see piles of them near the berm, and then we also see them scattered on the approach to the wall, consistent with civilians as if they've been shot while running by a sniper or by people on the ground.
And so that berm has been built to try to prevent people from fleeing, even just civilians from fleeing this town.
Yes. And we have documented the construction of the berm over the last more than 2 months. And we've watched them with bulldozers constructed on a daily basis. And now fully encircles the city. There are only 4 to 5 access points controlled by the Rapid Support Forces through which civilians could exit the berm.
And is it your guess or understanding that, all of these bodies that you're seeing are civilians, or are some of them fighters?
The areas that we see Rapid Support Forces house-to-house clearance operations occurring within were areas that were known civilian refuges, primarily of Zagawa, Fur, and Berti tribal people who had been seeking refuge in these neighborhoods during the siege.
You have been monitoring movements in El Fasher for years. Is what you are seeing right now, the details that you have just outlined for us, is that a surprise?
It is heartbreaking, and it's not surprising. In the summer of 2023, my team and I, then working with the U.S. Department of State, warned the United Nations Security Council in a private session that we were seeing activity by the Rapid Support Forces, which suggested an intent to put Al-Fashir under siege, and if it was captured, to slaughter the people there. We then warned the U.S. government to the level of the U.S. National Security Council and the intelligence community that we thought Al-Fashir would be under siege within months. We warned them again in the fall. For 18 months, my team and I, having left U.S. government service on Sudan, have independently at Yale been monitoring Al-Fashir, producing almost one report a week for 18 months. This is the most accurately monitored mass atrocity with early warning, arguably in human history. People can say we couldn't act to stop it, but they can't say we didn't know.
So what could have been done differently to prevent this from getting to the point where it is now?
Three things needed to happen. One is diplomatic and political and economic pressure on the Rapid Support Forces' primarily backer, which is the United Arab Emirates. During the siege, we could watch the sophistication, the quality, and the scale of the Rapid Support Forces' weaponry change. At the start of the fight for Al-Fashir, they didn't have drones. By the time Al-Fashir fell, they had fixed-wing drones, suicide drones, quadcopter drones, and the ability to launch missiles from the air. Not only did the United States not put pressure on the UAE, under President Biden, it signed a major defense partnership with the UAE. The second thing that needed to happen is really a massive humanitarian surge to be able to access Al-Fashir. The third thing that needed to happen, really at the end of the day, is a concerted effort to enforce UN Security Council Resolution 2736 from last summer, which mandated a ceasefire. It was great on paper, but it had no teeth. And now here we are.
So at this point, what is the best way to stop this violence?
The best way to stop this violence is full global pressure on the United Arab Emirates to say that if RSF does not stop, you will be facing sanctions. That is the only lever. And we are running out of time. As each hour goes by, as each new satellite pass happens, we expect to see that the killing that started 48 hours ago is only spreading and only picking up speed.
You are very used to looking at these satellite images of things that you have labeled in the photos, objects and stains on the ground. It is very dystopian feeling, perhaps, to look at these satellite images as someone who's not used to it and see things labeled red stain and object, and it is, in fact, bodies and lives and blood that we're talking about. It is a very clinical way to study this, but I gather important.
We have to practice as analysts, a very difficult high wire act emotionally of being able to clinically, objectively observe what we're seeing in satellite data, knowing that it's mothers, it's fathers, it's children.
I would guess that you were hoping you would not be documenting this type of atrocity. Do you feel that it will produce an impact when it, as of yet, has not?
I don't know. At this point, I don't feel much different than I did 2 years ago because I knew the international community did not have it in them, in us, to respond. It meant having to deal with the economic and political alliances with the United Arab Emirates. And there seemed to be, as Frederick Douglass said in Talking of Slavery, power concedes nothing without a demand. There was no demand here. 20 years ago, American students were marching in the street chanting, "Save Darfur." There are no student movements like that now, no bracelets, no lawn signs. And so in many ways, what's happened now seemed inevitable 2 years ago. No one was going to come to rescue these people because they didn't matter more than America and the West's relationship with the UAE. But that doesn't change how much it hurts.
Nathaniel Raymond directs the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Nathaniel.
Thank you.
In Russia, Vladimir Putin is touting a new long-range nuclear missile. It's called the Burevestnik. That is the Russian word for an ocean bird known for its ability to fly through storms. It's called a storm petrel. Putin announced on Sunday that the cruise missile had been tested successfully last week, flying for 15 hours straight across nearly 9,000 miles. As the world's Matthew Bell reports, the new weapon has to do with more than the war in Ukraine.
In the video from Sunday, Vladimir Putin appears in a military uniform with a few top commanders. They talk about the war in Ukraine, and then Putin mentions the newly tested nuclear-powered cruise missile. The Burevestnik, Putin says, is a weapon that no other country in the world has. And at one point, he gives his army chief some instructions. We have to start preparing the infrastructure for deploying these weapons, Putin tells the army chief, who responds with a simple yes. The idea for this Russian cruise missile has been around for years, but this would be its first actual test. What's different is that instead of a jet engine, it's propelled by an onboard nuclear reactor. In theory, that means it could fly much farther and more easily evade missile defense systems, says Jeffrey Lewis. He's a weapons expert at Middlebury College.
I think the Kremlin is exaggerating a little bit. It's an exotic weapon. It does have the ability to fly very long ranges or for very long periods of time. But it's not invincible. It's another step in an arms race to nowhere.
When I ask Lewis if the Burevestnik could help Russia win the war in Ukraine, he says that's not what it's for.
This weapon is really intended to intimidate the United States. It's designed to defeat U.S. missile defenses. So this weapon is really about threatening us, and it's about threatening countries in Europe that are supporting Ukraine.
Lewis says the entire arms control framework, built mostly by the United States and Russia, has essentially collapsed. There's only one treaty left standing, the New START Treaty. It expires in February. If Moscow and Washington fail to extend New START, it means the two nuclear nations that together hold nearly 90% of all nuclear weapons on Earth would suddenly be without an arms control treaty for the first time since the early 1970s.
So we're living in this era in which we're competing and we're threatening one another. But we have abandoned the work of trying to figure out how to both live on this planet.
The real motivating factor behind the new Russian cruise missile is something that the Trump administration announced back in May.
Thank you for being here in the Oval Office as we make a historic announcement about the Golden Dome Missile Defense Shield.
This is a promotional video from the White House. Trump says his Golden Dome would finish the job that Ronald Reagan began 40 years ago with missile defense. Matthew Bunn is an expert on energy security and foreign policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard.
I believe that Golden Dome, like President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative before it, is a foolish waste of money that is likely to provoke nuclear arms buildups by our adversaries and leave us less secure than we were when we started.
Bunn says the U.S. decided against building a nuclear-powered rocket or missile because if one ever crashed, it would create an unintended nuclear disaster. And he points out that U.S. nuclear policy choices are much more complicated now compared to the Cold War days because China is rapidly building up its nuclear forces. On top of that, China is cooperating with Russia through what they call a no-limits strategic partnership. Matthew Bunn says the debate in Washington is about whether to let the New START Treaty expire and then expand U.S. nuclear forces beyond the old limits, or, alternatively, to try to negotiate another arms control agreement for the future with both Russia and China. On that score, Bunn says there's a lot of good news to point to here.
More than four-fifths of all the nuclear weapons that used to exist in the world have been destroyed. More than half of all the countries that once started nuclear weapons programs gave them up. The remaining nuclear weapons and nuclear materials in the world are just far more secure and far better accounted for than they were at the dawn of this century.
But if the United States insists on having the ability to threaten the nuclear deterrence of both Russia and China, Bunn says what comes next is an extended, unlimited nuclear arms race. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Hurricane Melissa made landfall in Jamaica shortly after noon today, Jamaica time. The Category 5 storm is one of the strongest Atlantic hurricanes ever recorded, and by far the largest to slam into the island.
The storm has already caused casualties, and the death toll is likely to rise. Melissa brings both heavy rain and sustained winds of around 185 miles per hour. Gusts are reaching up to 220 miles per hour. That is the wind on the ground, sound from the Associated Press.
Just to put those intense winds in perspective, 220 miles an hour is about the speed of a Formula One race car on a straightaway. Obviously, winds that fast can do a lot of damage. One particular concern, Jamaica's steep mountains and narrow valleys, where heavy rains can trigger landslides. Officials have been warning Jamaicans for days to heed evacuation orders. One minister cautioned that now is not the time to be brave. In other words, don't try to stick this one out.
At a news conference, Jamaican Prime Minister Andrew Holness said the country expects devastating results.
There is no infrastructure in the region that can withstand a Category 5. There is going to be damage if there is a Category 5.
Holness also cautioned that the cleanup and damage assessment after the storm will be slow. Jamaica resident Earl Cameron warned others to take those warnings seriously.
It's not a joke. It is very serious, guys. And it is going to be something different. They will be hard to digest when this is over.
We will continue to follow the news from the Caribbean over the coming days.
Here's some surprising news from the animal kingdom. It seems a tiny ant has turned the field of evolutionary biology on its head. I'm talking about a harvester ant in southern Europe that can do something long considered impossible. It can produce offspring of an entirely different species. The World's Jerry Haddon went to the French city of Montpellier to meet the biologist who made the discovery.
There are a few requisites to qualify as a species, says evolutionary biologist Jonathan Promiguier.
But the most common one is a new member of the same species. If you're two individuals with similar genetic and morphological features that can produce a fertile offspring.
As in two pigs making a piglet. Womiguier says members of different species can get together. Take the classic example of horse meets donkey.
Sure, they can hybridize, but they don't produce a fertile offspring because they produce a mule.
The mighty mule, strong but sterile. So for life to perpetuate itself, the theory goes, it needs species to stick with their own. Think Noah's Ark with all the world's animals embarking two by two. Except now these little guys are saying, hang on. This is the sound of the harvester ant species Messor ibericus chewing away on seeds. It wasn't their racket that first drew Romiguier's attention. It was the DNA he found in the colony. DNA of two separate species. Womiguier's taken me to his ant room in the University of Montpellier's biology department. The walls are lined with shelves where dozens of ant species crawl about in clear plastic tubs. When Womiguier looked into why the ibericus nest contained two different genomes, he discovered something unique about the queens.
They're able to lay individuals that belong to different species, males of their own species and male of another species.
Two males, two species, from the same queen. How? Well, the ibericus queens have evolved to mate with their own kind and with males from another ant species called Mesostructor. Structor and ibericus split from each other around 5 million years ago, which coincidentally, Romiguier says, is when humans and chimpanzees separated. He says it makes for a good comparison.
It would be like, let's say, a chimp that is able to produce human males so they can mate with them to produce hybrid human-chimp that will basically do all their tasks.
In the ant's case, the hybrid ibericus structor offspring become the workers, and like the mule, they're sterile. They gather all the food, feed the queens, but Womiguier says something else is going on, something never seen before.
So the particularity of this species is that in around 10% of eggs, there is just the DNA of the other species. It's just of the father.
In other words, what hatches from those Ibericus eggs are perfect clones of the Structor dad. When they grow up, they'll mate with new Ibericus queens, repeating the cycle.
The stunning point is that they produce these clones and hybrid workers in some parts of Europe where Mesostructor doesn't even exist. Mesostructor colonies are not even present.
Ibericus doesn't need to go find Structor ant colonies for mating because, again, they're cloning Structor males. This process, the successful, if convoluted, interbreeding between species, has never been observed in living creatures, ever. Womiguiye's findings were recently published in the journal Nature.
I saw that and I emailed it to a colleague who's teaching an entomology course. Yeah, and basically just said, check out this crazy thing that ants are doing.
This is evolutionary biologist Dave Angelini, who chairs the biology department at Colby College.
I mean, I don't know that this has ever been seen before. And so this is one of these really kind of mind-bending examples where one species is kind of exploiting another, but that boundary between exploitation and what the species really is kind of becomes blurred.
The exploitation Angelini refers to goes both ways. Ibericus exploits the Structor clones to make worker ants. Structor males exploit the queens to get cloned. Remove one of the two species from the colony, and all the ants die. As to why these species have evolved this way, that's still a mystery. It could be that the sterile hybrid workers are more robust than the parents, giving the colony an advantage. But beyond the why, does this enhance our understanding of evolution? Are there any practical takeaways, say, for reproductive therapies or medicine? It's too early to tell, but it is a good example of how natural selection is always more clever than we assume. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Montpellier, France.
And now let's catch up on a few other headlines we're following.
It's a classic mix-up, Julius Caesar versus Augustus Caesar. That distinction seems to have slid by some schools in Queensland, Australia, where seniors were taught the wrong curriculum. Schools were notified a year ago that Julius Caesar would be a topic for an ancient history exam to be administered tomorrow. Well, the kids are going to have a hard time. According to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Brisbane State High School mistakenly taught the wrong Caesar, Augustus. At least seven other schools in the province made the same error.
Regarding the cross-border TV commercial feud here in North America, Ontario Premier Doug Ford said the Ronald Reagan ad about tariffs was, quote, best ad I ever ran. The ad showed the former U.S. president listing the problems tariffs cause. Ontario paid for the ad to run during games one and two of baseball's World Series for the matchup between Toronto and Los Angeles. The ad has since been pulled, but Ford says he made his point.
That World Series, by the way, is shaping up to be one for the ages. Crazy, 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 crazy is how Toronto Blue Jays pitcher Max Scherzer described last night's 18-inning game. 6 hours and 39 minutes after the first pitch, L.A. took the win. Another corker with Game 4 tonight. Get out the popcorn.
And those are a few more headlines for you today.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. President Trump is scheduled to meet Chinese leader Xi Jinping tomorrow, with trade being the top focus. One thing not getting much attention is human rights.
The Chinese government's track record for repression is well known, especially targeting Uyghurs, the Muslim ethnic group in the province of Xinjiang. This next story is about a Uyghur man who tried to open a Uyghur kindergarten and the reaction he got from Chinese authorities.
It is the starting point for a series from the Click Here podcast about Uyghurs fighting to keep their culture alive. The host of that podcast, Dina Temple Rastin, takes it from here.
If you were to tell a young Abdulwali Ayub that his people were oppressed by the Chinese, he would have been surprised to hear it.
I didn't feel any discrimination when I was really young because there is no Chinese to discriminate us.
Han Chinese make up about 90% of China's population. But in the far northwestern reaches of the country, where Abdulwali was born, most people are Uyghur, a mix of Turkish and Asian ancestry, a Muslim minority with their own culture and language.
I don't know Chinese speak Chinese. I assumed all of the people are speaking Uyghur.
Was Chinese sort of like a foreign language? The same way we might take French or Spanish?
Yes, it's a foreign language, yeah. One of the foreign...
Got it.
Like, yeah.
But as he got older, he did start to notice some small things, like no one in his school books looked like him.
And I asked my father why, and he said that don't ask these difficult questions. You will understand when you grow up.
When Abdulwali Ayub was a teenager, the landscape around him in northwestern China was beginning to shift. A mining company had discovered valuable minerals in a nearby mountain. And almost overnight, Chinese soldiers arrived to guard what had suddenly become an important site. One afternoon, Abdulwali was riding his bike, just a kid out with his friends. Chinese soldiers were a fixture in Xinjiang by then, and everyone knew the routine. You pass them, you stop, you nod, you show respect. But that day, his friend looked at him and said, "I dare you. Ride right past them. No stopping. Just pedal."
For us, if anyone can, like, pass that line without saying hello, we feel ourselves we are hero.
It was a game.
Yeah, it was a game. We are kids. How do we know?
The soldiers weren't playing. They surrounded Abdulwali and beat him with sticks and the butts of their guns. His father had to pull them off. That night, Abdulwali couldn't even sit down. But it wasn't just the violence. There were smaller humiliations, like they'd invite soldiers to eat fruit from their orchards, but instead of picking it, the soldiers would shoot it off the trees, leaving their orchards littered with bullets. Or they'd shoot people's pets. It seemed just for fun, just to remind everyone who was in charge. Even the local library wasn't immune. One day, Abdulwali walked up to the desk and asked for books in Uyghur. And the librarian looked at him and said they were gone.
She said that I couldn't give you those books because those books are banned. And she cried because very few books and the books are banned.
That's how it starts. Not with explosions, not even with words, but with missing books. A quiet dismantling. Abdulwali's father had always been loyal to the Communist Party, but after that beating, Abdulwali started noticing these subtle shifts in his dad.
Before, my father just collect books randomly. Then he started collecting books deliberately.
His dad kept those books in a secret box, his own quiet rebellion against forgetting. And that small act of defiance planted a seed in his son. When it came time for college, Abdulwali chose linguistics. He'd started to understand the power of language, and he wanted to protect it and preserve it. Eventually, that took him to graduate school, in Kansas, of all places. It was a long way from Xinjiang, but the questions that haunted him about identity and belonging, they came with him. And then something happened, something small and personal, but it hit like a lightning bolt. It happened after he enrolled his daughter in a local Kansas preschool.
When she came, she speaks Uyghur fluently. She was perfect in her Uyghur, but she lost her language in the U.S. in 6 months.
And that was the moment he realized that language isn't just how we speak. It's how we remember who we are. It's how identity takes root. And it was there in Kansas, in the land of yellow school buses and PTA meetings, that Abdulwali had this idea. He knew that language didn't begin in textbooks. It started way before that, on playgrounds, in lullabies, in the first words spoken at home.
There is no Uyghur kindergarten. All of the kindergartens are Chinese kindergarten, like quote-unquote bilingual kindergarten, but in reality it's Chinese kindergarten. Because of kindergarten, we are losing this language.
And that's when it hit him. If the loss begins that early, maybe the solution does too. Maybe a preschool could keep the Uyghur language alive. When Abdulwali returned to China, he went to work trying to build his kindergarten. He started gathering support, looking for investors. And his pitch was simple.
Look, this is the way to keep our language alive.
But even that was too bold for some.
And they already afraid of my idea, like about this promoting Uyghur language.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was a dangerous idea.
Abdulelli wasn't breaking the rules. He was working in the margins, teaching children in Uyghur before the law had a chance to say he couldn't. The Mandarin language was mandatory in primary school, but for kindergartens, the rules weren't so clear.
There is no clear policy that kindergarten should use Uyghur, should use Chinese, like what language should use in kindergarten.
So he slipped in through that gap. Finally, his brother took a chance on him and invested $80,000. And then, in another stroke of luck, a friend offered him a building for the school. Abdulelli started recruiting, just 6 students to start. And with that, the first Uyghur language kindergarten was born. And they gave it a name that mattered.
We call it Nurhan. Nur means light. Han means king. Light of king.
It looked like any kindergarten, with nap time and snack time and then music time. The children began each morning with a song, in Uyghur. Not a protest song, just a melody in their own tongue. And for Abdulelli, that was enough. He'd sit in the front row smiling, because this wasn't just music. This was language, alive and out loud. And he had other ideas, unconventional tools to keep Uyghur alive.
At that time, I used Dora.
Dora the Explorer?
Yeah.
Dora! Come on, Dora! All right!
Why I use Dora? Because there is an English part and there is a Spanish part, right?
Right.
The Spanish part, I use Uyghur.
Wow, you just dubbed it over.
Yeah.
It wasn't flashy, but it worked. After a few short months of this, they got some official visitors. State security officers showed up asking for names and phone numbers and the list of parents who dared to send their kids there.
I expect that to happen, but not that quick.
He was happy the officers couldn't actually read his curriculum because he wasn't just teaching Uyghur. Abdulelli had another goal, to teach kids how to think. Because when he had first started working with the kids, something felt a little off. They didn't act like kids. They followed every instruction, immediately, without exception, without complaining.
I said, why your kids just listen to my word really carefully, just not act like a kid? She said, it's because of the former kindergarten. If the kids don't listen to them, they just beat them. That's why she's afraid. These kids learned that behavior. It's because of Chinese education.
Fitting in isn't just a cultural expectation, it's policy. So obedience is woven into every lesson, right alongside math and reading. And that's what made Abdulelli's next decision feel almost radical, maybe even revolutionary.
So we didn't only teach kids language, we teach kids how to be an independent human being. We gave them choice.
It worked. The school took off. 6 kids became 24, then 100, then several hundred. It spread hand to hand, phone to phone, mother to mother. And the kindergarten stopped being just a kindergarten. It became a movement. They started calling it the Mother Language Movement. A quiet revolution, one classroom at a time. But movements, even quiet ones, don't go unnoticed forever. When they moved to open a second school, the new director did something different. He filed for a permit. The government said no, so he posted the rejection letter online. Each day he applied again. Each day he was denied, and each rejection posted. What started as digital dissent slipped into the real world, and people started to gather at the government offices, demanding answers, wanting accountability. And eventually, the government blinked. The school was approved. And while it felt like a win, it wasn't a safe one. Police began harassing the staff. One by one, they quit. Then the director himself stepped down. And finally, the landlord pulled the lease.
And then, the place we rented, She said that I'm not going to rent this place anymore. And we said, we have 5 years contract. Our school paralyzed because we can't get that money back.
They had to shut down.
We had two big rooms full of the students' clothes and the students' quilts and the sheets. Two rooms full of those items which students use in daily life. Think about it.
And he did. The movement had grown too quickly, too publicly. And now it felt like it could break, or worse, even explode if people heard about the shutdown.
Because, look, there are online 1.5 million people are following us. They will take some action against the government. Bloody clash will happen. And then, people will be arrested, and the people who followed the movement will be in trouble in the future. I don't want that to happen.
So he created a story, a way to quiet the tension. He rented a new building nearby and told everyone that the school was simply relocating, nothing to worry about, and invited volunteers to help renovate it for students he knew would never be there.
I am doing this, but I know I'm fooling the people.
He kept up the act to keep the peace and to buy time to figure out his next move. But that time was cut short. One day, during the renovation, a black car pulled up. Security officers stepped out. And Abdulwali knew exactly who they were, but he stayed in character. He started walking to the car and told the volunteers he'd be just a minute.
I have visitors there, and don't stop, keep working. I will talk with them for a while.
But once inside the car, they cuffed him, took his phone, and pulled a black hood over his head. He'd been detained before, but this time, it felt different.
I thought that this is the ending. I thought maybe they will kill me.
Abdulwali wasn't just being questioned. He was about to be turned into an enemy of the state. What followed was a year in a succession of different jails and hours of interrogation. Sometimes they locked him in a cage in the center of a cell, and two armed guards would be on either side of him. Three interrogators were in front of him, and they would start to scream, "You're trying to create a separate country for Uyghurs."
"Yes or no?" I said, "No." "And you are training resistance force to incite terrorism?" "Yes or no?" "No." "And you met Uyghur politicians in Washington and you promised to work with them?" "Yes or no?" "No."
And then they reached for their metal batons, slid them under his arms.
And then they put electric shock.
And turned on the current. They did other things too, but Abdulwali didn't want to talk about them. Some of it, he said, he'd rather forget. Eventually, he was sentenced. He got 18 months in prison and ended up serving 15. And when he walked out, the world he stepped back into wasn't the one he remembered.
I found the Uyghur homeland changed completely, just day and night. Every 500 meters, there's a checkpoint, and every 10 Uyghur family controlled by one guy.
Each block had one guy assigned to watch the families. There were cameras everywhere, making it clear that every word might be recorded. And if the authorities had accused you of wrongdoing, every time the card was scanned, a special sound would ring out.
When you swipe your ID card to get on the bus, and then do-do-do-t, the sound.
And with that sound came some limits. He couldn't get a job. He couldn't rent a house. He began to fear for his family's life. In 2015, Abdulwali quietly left the home he'd worked so hard to preserve, and he's been in exile since then. But even from afar, he hasn't stopped trying to help his people. He collects the stories of other Uyghurs who fled. He writes children's books, stories about memory, about identity, about home. And he keeps telling his own story, even though his family wishes he wouldn't. While visiting a fellow Uyghur exile in Turkey, he got the news. His sister had been arrested back in China.
But the problem is not only my sister. There are, like, all of my friends being arrested. All of my friends, all of the parents who sent their kids to me, and they being arrested. And how can I say that, yes, because of my sister, I should stop? What am I doing?
The schools he built? Gone. The first was turned into a re-education camp. Mandarin is now the required language for all kindergartens in China. More than 1 million Uyghurs are believed to have been detained in camps across far western China, cut off from their families, their culture, their language. We asked the Chinese embassy in Washington about Abdulwali's story, and they wouldn't address his case directly. But in a written statement, a spokesperson said that, quote, people of all ethnic groups in Xinjiang fully enjoy economic, social, cultural, civil, and political rights, and that Xinjiang was, quote, a prosperous and stable place. But stability is not freedom, and silence is not peace.
For the world, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Government repression of Uyghurs takes many forms, especially digital surveillance.
Your phone is with you all the time. It is like your digital fingerprints.
That's next week in our series from Click Here from Recorded Future News. Our story was produced by Sean Powers. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Let's talk critical minerals, materials that are vital for industries like tech and defense. The country known for its abundance of critical minerals and rare earths is China. But President Trump is making deals across Asia to pin down alternatives to China's dominance of the market. Gracelyn Baskerin is an expert in the topic at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She's been looking at recent U.S. deals with countries in the Asia-Pacific region.
We've really seen that in the last week with agreements happening in Australia, Malaysia, Thailand, Japan. And these agreements all look a little bit different. Some of them are joint financing. Some of them are for the first right for American companies to potentially come and extract some of these reserves. Some of them are for stockpiling efforts. What we're really seeing is that President Trump is looking to counter China in China's territory.
So the countries that are getting in these rare earth mineral deals that Trump is brokering with them, what is in it for them?
Really, for a lot of countries, I mean, we are living in a very interesting economic world order. And what I mean by that is historically, China has been the only source of mining investment and offtake. And that's increasingly becoming a risk. We're seeing that China's economy is struggling with high levels of deflation, high levels of unemployment, soft demand. So it's a de-risking strategy for these countries.
So this is important not just for American companies, right? These rare earths impact the whole world. Everyone wants them. But will all countries around the world benefit if these deals go through?
Almost every country will benefit. It's not necessarily in China's interest. But to be very clear, what China did was they overplayed their hand this year. And what I mean by that is when they rolled out these rare earth export restrictions in April and again in October this month, it targeted the whole world. And so even, for example, Japanese automaker Suzuki actually had to stop production of its Swift model. So it's not really surprising that Japan and the U.S. signed an agreement this week to collaborate to counter that level of bullying from its neighbor. So these export restrictions have hit countries around the world. So what it's really become is a bit of a rallying cry to get countries to work together to counter that monopoly that China has exerted and weaponized.
Before we go on, maybe a couple of definitions here. There are critical minerals and then there are rare earth minerals. Can you just spell out that distinction?
Yeah. So when we think about critical minerals, we think about of a basket about 50 to 55 minerals here in the U.S. And these are minerals where you a really broad basket that you need for economic security, but also ones where a single point of failure, like there's a single mine, it's overwhelmingly concentrated in adversarial hands. But it could be anything from like lithium and cobalt and nickel, which are like large scale base metals, to some of your minor metals that you need. Rare earths are actually a group of 17 of those minerals. Right? So it's a subsect of those minerals. And China has particularly weaponized those rare earths because there's two types of rare earths. There's light rare earths and heavy rare earths. It's just done by atomic weight. And China actually controls 99% of processing for those heavy rare earths. So because they're so important and because the U.S. doesn't have a lot of heavy rare earths, China processes in them. Within that big basket of, you know, 50 to 55 critical minerals, we have doubled down some of our efforts to focus on those rare earths.
When China is processing all these rare earth minerals, what are they turning them into that the world wants so much?
So they're turning them into these permanent magnets, and these permanent magnets are really important, particularly for defense applications, but they're also used in automotives and various other end uses. Now, what China did with the export restrictions from earlier this month is they said, okay, well, if the permanent magnets use more than 0.1% of Chinese heavy rare earths, and they use Chinese technology, then they are now subject to these export controls regardless of where they are produced. So these permanent magnets, and again, China produces 93% of the world's permanent magnets, are the next level of weaponization.
So safe to say that China currently has the muscle and capacity. Can you give us a sort of 35,000-foot view of how rare earth minerals are distributed worldwide?
Yeah, so China has the biggest reserves. Then the next ones that we know are the next biggest, number two and three, are Vietnam and Brazil. You have Australia comes in, India comes in, Saudi Arabia comes in, and all of these countries are now trying to develop these reserves. You're almost at a point, and this, it'll be interesting, we can, you know, have pick up this conversation 5 years from now, if, you know, rare earths are actually a very, very small market. You know, it's not a lithium. You need a lot of lithium, right? When I think about lithium, I think about tons. When I think about rare earths, I think about kilograms, is whether we end up overdeveloping this industry and we have too much. That's actually the risk we have, because all of these countries that I just mentioned are now trying to develop their reserves.
So the U.S. and China are kind of in the headlines when it comes to all this. But how eager are other countries around the world to get in on these deals? Like, who are the big national competitors out there?
So the Gulf is a huge play, right? And if you look at, for example, at Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030, they are willing to put a lot of money. Mining is one of their core pillars, but they're not just mining to mine, and they're not just processing to process. They want to build a defense industry, data center industry, EV industry, right? So they're looking at a mine to manufactured goods. So the Gulf is a huge player now. But increasingly, you're seeing, obviously, Australia, Japan, South Korea. All of these countries are looking, because the reality is that the future is so materials intensive that if you don't have access to minerals, you will not be part of the future economy. When we think about things like AI and data centers, they are so deeply interlinked. So really, you see some of these big capital heavy players coming, but everybody's trying to get a piece of the pie right now.
So, Gracelyn, we're looking across the world at the demand for things like electric vehicles and high-tech gadgets, computing capacity, AI, things every country on Earth is using. When it comes to the extraction of these minerals and the deals around them, how much are the environmental costs being factored in? And in your opinion, how should they be factored in?
You know, one of the reasons we didn't develop a lot of these capabilities in the U.S. and in our allied countries over the last 20 years is there is certainly a negative environmental footprint. It emits a lot of waste, water, gases, and other forms of pollution. And we were really happy for it to be what we call not in my backyard, NIMBYism. So we were very happy for China to play the dominant in this space, but also absorb all of those negative environmental challenges. The reality is now we're learning to do this cleaner than we've ever been able to do it before. And that is really the beauty of research and development and innovation, is that I need less water, I can manage my environmental fallout better. But it is one of the trade-offs that we have in this world, is the environmental externalities of mining up against the tensions of needing to meet our security needs.
Gracelyn Baskerin directs the Critical Mineral Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. She was explaining how the U.S. and others are trying to get access to critical minerals and rare earths without relying on China.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more, fjc.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
From PRX.